Welcome to A Moment of Bach, where we take our favorite moments from the composer's vast musical output, just a minute's worth or even a few seconds, and show you why we think they are remarkable. We are your hosts, Alex and Christian Giebert, and today's moment comes from the famed Goldberg Variations, variation number 7, sometimes known as the Canary Jig.
And this will be the first of two looks that we take at this jig, at this 7th variation of the Goldberg Variations. Part 2 to come 2 weeks later. The improvisational pianist Dan Tepfer calls this variation a innocent dance between two young people. It has only two voices, that is, there's only two active parts at the same time. There's the top one and the bottom one. And the way they interplay with each other and bounce off of each other suggests to Dan Tepfer a sort of youthful dance and exuberance, almost shy and playful. This is usually labeled as a jig, a type of dance, but it's worth looking at the manuscript, which doesn't say anything on it about what the type of dance should be. All we know is the meter and the characteristic rhythm that just keeps repeating bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum. Now, taken literally, the rhythm notated is da, 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 dum. He kind of doesn't really play it like that, though. Kind of plays bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum, or something a little off-kilter.
He gives it a little bit of almost nervous energy. Goes along with your picture of the... of like the two dancers, you know?
Yeah. It's a whole world to open up if you consider, especially if you're a solo performer, like in the case of this performance, which is on harpsichord by Jean Rondeau, that you absolutely shouldn't just be beholden to the pulse and the beat as if it were like a computer or a metronome. In fact, you can't, because then the music doesn't really have any organic life to it. A good example of this would be like in jazz. You're taught as a jazz musician to read eighth notes as swung, which changes them from like one and two and three and four and to one da dum bum three and four and one and two. But what I'm speaking, the rhythm here is just a division from sets of two into sets of three. Bum 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 bum. But it doesn't have to be. You can make that first note a little longer. Bum ba bum ba bum. You know, you could try to divide those two notes into like 3 to 2. So, bum, 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 bum.
Yeah.
That's a little subtler. Or you could not put so much math to it and just try to make it a little bit, make that first note a little shorter, but not quite an eighth, not quite a straight eighth note. Dun, 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 something like that.
Yeah, I think he does something similar to the quintuplet thing that you're talking about. It's cool that you mentioned jazz, because jazz, the swing in jazz is also like very particular to the style, the subgenre of jazz. Most jazz musicians would not actually play swing as like literally a triplet, like 1 2 3 dum bum 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 bum. That would be considered pretty square, even though it's I don't think it's more triangular, isn't it actually? it's like three exact microbeats in there. It would be considered square to do that in a jazz context. You need to have a little bit of extra, you have to lay back a little bit and have a little extra space. In this, it's kind of a similar thing. And in sort of old-fashioned waltzes, which this is not, this is a jig, but in a similar way, old-fashioned waltzes, a lot of times you'll listen to like Viennese waltzes, like famous waltzes by Johann Strauss Jr., for example. When you listen to these recordings, you cannot count along with these recordings in a steady tempo. You know what I mean? They kind of bounce a little bit. Instead of being like 1 2 3 1 2 3, they kind of go like 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3. You know what I mean? It's very weird. It's not. It is specific, but it's hard to describe what it is because it's not an exact pulse thing.
That's partly the limitation of written out music, because music notation suggests or encourages us to think of things very quantized and even.
Yes.
And that's just not how musical pulse should be in most cases, especially in a fast dance type of thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be da 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 da.
But don't you think, Christian, that quantization actually is maybe one of the reasons why, like, a lot of modern people don't get into classical music as much, because it's just people are a little bit reluctant to try something that they don't understand in general in life. That's a generalization about life, but pop music in general does not have any tempo changes in it for the most part. There's a few examples, of course, just like anything, but people are not used to hearing rubato, ritardando, accelerando in their music, nor are they used to hearing a pulse that is not quantized like what you're saying, Christian, here. And when you listen to anything by J.S. Bach, there's almost always some ritardando at the end of the movement of whatever it is, if it's being played in the normal style that we would expect from Baroque, from late Baroque music of J.S. Bach, or any number of other tempo changes that the performers are adding to the music that's not written in. So those are all things that the quantization of, like, of the way of the digital audio workstations that are being used to produce most music nowadays, at least most commercial music, is not training us to hear those things.
No. And this happens in several different dimensions. The other one is pitch. And that doesn't have anything to do with computers. That just has to do with equal temperament.
But it does have to do with computers.
Well, it's how computers work.
Now there's pitch correction that can really lock everything exactly into the equal tempered system. I wonder if sometimes if J.S. Bach would have known about what autotune is, if he would have thought twice about trying to petition for the equal tempered system that he did, because of course that allowed him to write in many different keys. And I think we've talked about tuning systems before, but I guess my point is, nowadays with digital audio workstations, I'm sure you can do all kinds of crazy tunings if you want in experimental ways with digital stuff, but the fact is that most people for commercial music will use the standard 12-tone system that we have, equal temperament, as well as quantizing everything rhythmically. And, you know, what's the famous thing, "The medium is the message" by Marshall McLuhan? The medium of digital audio workstations is the music, like, that we're hearing. It's completely bridled by that. And I don't think it's easy for people to break out of that system and do something more interesting rhythmically or pitch-wise without sort of breaking the norms.
And like, it could actually make early music sound wrong to our modern ears, yeah, if it's tuned in a more natural acoustic way, which is a real shame. And I guess we should pause to say that what we specifically mean by quantization is putting everything into equal discrete chunks. So instead of all the beats being kind of natural, the way that this harpsichordist plays them, for example, just make them all exactly the same. That would be quantization. And a similar thing happened to pitch around the time of 1700s, 1750.
Which Bach was on the forefront of.
Yeah, because he wanted to use different keys. He wanted to write in different keys and be able to change from one key to a distantly related key. I'm going to try to spend less than 1 minute on this small soapbox. I actually really dislike quantization as a musical concept, also in terms of modernist music of the 20th century, because of what we now call serialism or 12-tone composition. The flattening out of all that stuff is somewhat against physics in a way.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't love, because in physics and in overtones, you get mathematical ratios that are almost equal tempered notes, but aren't really. And I think that something similar is at work here in these magical performances of Baroque dances, where it seems like a little off kilter, but it's more natural. And the reason why is because that's just how sound is. And if you do put sound in a box, if you put music in little boxes that are all the same size, in other words, if you quantize all the rhythms and pitches, does it work? Yes, but it's kind of dead inside. You know, it's kind of lifeless.
Yeah, it's missing life. It kind of feels like a thing that was written by AI, you know?
Yeah. And there can be other ways, of course, that like a Schoenberg piano piece can be performed that make it very musical, other than the actual selection of pitches, which is cool.
Usually it's like the performer is doing their best to inject something human into a piece like that, that might, and by the way, there's some stuff of Schoenberg that I love, but sometimes the pianist, for example, is like doing her darndest to try to get something out of this piece that's like so opaque. She's like, can I shine some light in here somehow by giving it a little human touch by the way they're performing it?
Oh, right? Yeah. And he wrote French suites. Yeah. So it's like he was actually writing this exact stuff. But the only thing that's really different is the pitch material being quantized in a certain way.
Right.
Which leads me to sort of, I guess, love everything about Schoenberg's piano music except for the relation between the pitches. It's just like, I would just wish they were somehow more connected organically. Anyway, I think that's pretty universal in music. If you ever hear like folk music that you kind of don't understand or something from another culture, but you can just realize that somehow you can innately know that it just is working. I think that's why. I think sometimes this is why, because it is not beholden to minute perfections like that.
Yeah.
And just like all 30 variations in some way or another, this does follow the basic harmonic framework of the aria that all of the variations are based on.
You know, it'd be kind of a cool exercise. And also, like, if you're an amateur pianist or something like that, it would be a cool exercise to just play the Goldberg, like, bass line, just one note per measure, along with any of your favorite movements here, because it will always work. Well, not always, maybe, but most of the time.
But
maybe
just
see if it will work. Yeah. And then it's sort of an easy way to sort of play along with some of this very complex music if you're not a good enough keyboardist to keep up with it, and most people aren't.
I wonder what would happen if you just replaced the left hand with the Goldberg, you know?
Oh, yeah. Huh, would you look at that?
It works.
Of course it works, and it not only just does it work harmonically, but it works voice leading wise too. Like you didn't come up against any parallel octaves.
No.
And now let's hear that moment again from this movement number 7 of the Goldberg Variations. If this introduction to a musical moment by Bach made you decide you want to listen to more of these Goldberg variations, the entire set is all one long video, splendidly recorded by Jean Rondeau for the Netherlands Bach Society. The YouTube episode is linked in our episode description. For more on this particular movement of the Goldberg variations, join us again in 2 weeks. We'll take 1 week in between there where I will talk about a cantata, and then after that we'll return to this movement because Christian has some more thoughts on it.
Which cantata?
That would be BWV 104, Du Hirte Israel Höre. And we talked about this very cantata in our first season, but I will be talking about a different movement, which is the bass aria.
Until next time, enjoy those moments.